Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
Hey, I am thrilled you're here this morning. This is an exciting time of the year here at Heritage, and I'm excited for you to be a part of it. We've got lots of things going on here at the start of the year, and I'm especially thinking about the group launch that Marty just oriented us to again this morning and how important that is in the life of our church and in your spiritual life and mine. And we're just 3 weeks away right now from Football Sunday. Super Bowl is coming back up, and if you've been with us in years past, we have a habit of kind of going all out on Football Sunday, and we come in our jerseys or our football t-shirts or our cheese heads or whatever it is that you've got to show your fandom, you know, and we'll watch a video presentation that day from NFL players who are Christians playing in the Super Bowl that night, you know, and so it's exciting to kind of connect and imagine that there's some of those folks who are taking their faith with them as they go into that big event. And so it's a great opportunity for you to bring a friend to church with you. That's 3 weeks from today. I hope you'll plan to be here and bring someone with you that day. But as we kick off the message this morning, I've got kind of an experiment that I want to run here. It's kind of a crowd participation kind of thing. What I want to do is, in just a few minutes, on the count of three, I'm going to ask all of you to get up and change seats. And I'm going to want you, if you would, to sit by somebody, not the people you came with, not your family, all that kind of stuff, but sit by somebody you don't know. Okay, there's a couple of caveats. If this is your first time at Heritage, I'm not going to make you do this. And if you have a baby or something like that, you don't have to do this. Okay, but everybody else, we're going to go sit by somebody we don't know. Okay, ready? One, two. I'm just kidding. We're not going to do that. There were like three extroverts in the room who were like, yes, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to make a new friend, you know, and all the rest of you, I could hear the groans and I could see it on your faces, you know, because you reacted the same way that I would have reacted if I was sitting in your chair. I would have been like, I can't believe he's going to make us do this, you know, like unreal. And see, the thing is, it's funny, because it's not the inconvenience of getting up and moving that's the problem, right? Y'all are all, you know, generous folks, I know. Like, you would have done that if I had asked you to do that. You would have just played along, most of you. It's not the inconvenience of moving. It's the idea of spending the rest of this message, and who knows how long that's going to be, sitting next to a stranger, right? Because that part's kind of weird. Because collectively, as a culture, we're kind of odd about strangers, right? Like, we're not exactly fully comfortable, even in a situation like this, where we kind of know everybody's kind of here for the same purpose and stuff like that. Like, we're just not totally ourselves around strangers. We're kind of nervous, and most of us aren't really excited about having to get too close to strangers. And like, if you were sitting at a table in a restaurant and there were empty seats and a stranger came and said, hey, can I sit here with you? You would have been like, I'm never coming to this restaurant ever again. You know, like, that's weird kind of stuff. And we're kind of weird about that in our culture. And I want you to hold on to that feeling. The feeling you had just a minute ago when you thought I was about to make you sit by a stranger. I want you to hold on to that feeling this morning as we think about what God has to say to us today. You see, last week we kicked off a message series that's called Neighbors, and we're talking about the concepts of neighboring and hospitality and the way that followers of Jesus are called to be good neighbors to the people in the world around us, to show love to people in our community. And when I say the word hospitality, there's probably a couple of possibilities of images that come to mind for you, okay? Some of you, when I say hospitality, you immediately think of like family gatherings and having people into your home and getting out the fine china or the finest chinette paper plates, you know, or whatever it is that you do. And everybody gathers around, everybody's crowded in. Maybe there's a kid's table over here and it's really loud, but it's the hospitality It's the warm welcome, that cozy feeling of connection that made everything feel so special. Or it could be that hospitality is like an anxiety trigger for you, because when you hear hospitality, you think, I'm about to be in charge of making sure everybody else has what they need, and that does not feel comfortable for me. But I know there's some of you also, maybe you work in the hospitality industry. We actually have a name for that. You know, we got people in our church who work in hotel operations and event planning and entertainment and food service. And you make it your business professionally to ensure that things are comfortable and convenient for the guests who visit your business place. But whichever of those pictures comes to mind for you, whether it's a family gathering in a home, or whether it's a hotel kind of setting or something like that, chances are that when you hear hospitality, you don't immediately think about sharing yourself, sharing your life, sharing your possessions with strangers for free. Right? That's not typically where our mind goes. In our culture, hospitality is usually something that you do for the people that you already like and love, and you invite them into your home, or it's something that comes at a price in a business kind of environment, right? It's not typical in our society to offer hospitality to strangers for nothing. And we typically don't expect much from strangers when we're out in public in terms of hospitality, except for maybe just the most basic gestures, like holding a door open for you as you're following them into a store or something like that. Somebody might, you know, hold the door so you didn't have to pull it. And that's about as much hospitality as we might expect from some stranger out in public. In fact, for most of us, we would have to know somebody a whole lot better than that before we would feel comfortable asking them to do anything bigger, right? Before we would feel comfortable asking for a very much bigger favor than that. And I've noticed that's kind of common. Something in our society has changed so that most of us go to great lengths to avoid having to ask other people for help. We try to do everything we can to avoid depending or relying on others. We live in this individualistic kind of culture, and depending on the generosity of others feels difficult to us. At times, I've heard people say it's embarrassing to have to ask somebody else for help. It can feel degrading to us, as if we've done something that is a failure with ourselves. But I wonder if you have ever been in the kind of position in your life where you needed help and you simply had no other choice but to ask somebody. I wonder if you've ever been in that kind of moment where you're in desperate need, and you've run out of options, and the only thing left is to ask somebody else to step in, whether you're comfortable with that or not. Because the truth is that hospitality takes on an entirely new meaning when you are the one who needs to receive it. Hospitality means something totally different when you are counting on it, when you're depending on it. And I want to show you a passage in the New Testament book of Luke this morning. It contains one of the most familiar stories from the life of Jesus of all of them. It's one that most of you will have heard of before today. But we're going to look at this old familiar story and try to do it with a new lens, a new set of eyes this morning, because this 2,000-year-old story has got something to say to us about the kind of hospitality that God expects from people who follow Christ. So we're going to be in Luke chapter 10. If you've got a Bible on the app on your phone, you want to join us there. Luke chapter 10. We're going to start in verse 25. And when you get there, you're stepping in, looking in at this episode in Jesus's life. It starts with Jesus having a conversation in public with a expert in the Jewish legal system, all right, their religious law. Jesus is having a conversation with a legal expert in Israel, and the expert is asking the kinds of questions that would immediately give you a sense of this teacher, Jesus, this teacher's worldview and philosophy. It's the kind of question that you ask in public so that everybody who's listening can kind of get an idea of what's this teacher all about? What's this teacher trying to say? What is the message that this teacher wants to give to the world? But it's also the kind of question whose answer would immediately put Jesus in one camp or the other. And it's going to be divisive. And so the question that the legal expert asks Jesus is, what are the requirements? What do I have to do to inherit eternal life? And the answer to that question leads down one different trail of thought or another. And so Jesus, in very typical Jesus style, he turns the question back to the legal expert. Well, you're a legal expert. You tell me, what do you think it says? What do you think the requirements are? What does the law require in your opinion? And the man answers. He says, in order to gain eternal life, you got to love God and you got to love your neighbor. And Jesus says, exactly. Like, Jesus affirms that answer 100%. In fact, there are moments recorded in other accounts of the life of Jesus where Jesus not only affirms that answer, but he gives that answer word for word. He says the two greatest commands are to love God and love your neighbor, and everything else follows along with those. If you get those two right, everything else kind of takes care of itself. But in this instance, in this episode, this legal expert, he's wanting a little more clarification. He's wanting to get a little more specific, particularly about that whole loving your neighbor part, because if God expects for you to love your neighbor, it would be really nice to know who God is talking about. It would be nice to know who's God referring to. What does God have in mind when he says, love your neighbor like you love yourself? And so the man asks Jesus a follow-up question. He says, okay, you said my answer was right. Love God, love your neighbor. Those are the ways to inherit eternal life. But who exactly is my neighbor? Who are we talking about here? What are you referring to? And Jesus replies with a story. It's not a true story. It's not a news article. It's a made-up story. It's a parable, like a fable, to teach a lesson. And it goes like this. Jesus says, there was a man that was walking down from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's a 17-mile trip, desolate, out in the wilderness. He's walking down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he's attacked by robbers. And they stripped him of his clothes, and they beat him, and they went away, and they left him half dead. All right. Now, remember, this is a fictitious story, but just imagine there's some guy traveling this desolate area in Jerusalem. He gets mugged. He gets left badly beaten on the side of the road. And the next verse says, a priest, one of the Jewish priests, one of the people who leads and works in the temple, offers sacrifices and sacraments, one of the priests happened to be going down the same road. And when he looked at the man, when he saw the man, noticed him over here on the side of the road, he passed by on the other side of the road. So you got this religious leader who walks by, sees the victim, and keeps going. In fact, picks up his pace a little bit. All right. And then verse 32, also, or so too, a Levite. These are one of the assistants to the priests. These are one of the people who work in the temple and help take care of the temple and help with all of the things that need to be done to offer worship there. He's a religious official. A Levite, when he came to the place in the road and saw this man laying in the ditch, he passed by on the other side. Same situation, same outcome. A member of the clergy sees a victim and does absolutely nothing to help. In fact, he gets out of Dodge just as quick as he can. But then the next verse in the story is the kicker that would have surprised everyone who heard Jesus say it. And it goes like this. It says, but a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to the spot where the man was, and when he saw this guy, he took pity on him. He went to him, and he bandaged his wounds, and he poured on oil and wine, the best options for medication and salve that he had at the moment. And he put the man on his own donkey so that he was going to walk the rest of the way. And he brought him to an inn, and he took care of him. And it says the next day he took out some money. So that means he spent the night helping care for this man, nursing his wounds, helping take care of him. The next day he takes out some money, 2 denarii, and he gave the money to the innkeeper. And he said, look after this guy. And when I come back, I will reimburse you for any extra expense that you may have incurred. All right. So this is an extreme example. And in case you didn't recognize this story already, the story has come to be known over the centuries of Christian history as the story of the Good Samaritan. In fact, it's such an influential story that Good Samaritan has inspired the naming of hospitals and hospice organizations and international relief funds and humanitarian organizations and housing agencies. I mean, there are organizations all over the world that whose name is some variation of Good Samaritan because of this story. And there's some really inspiring stuff in here about going the extra mile for somebody who has a real need, being extremely compassionate and generous. But I want you to recognize that the real shocker in this story is not about the generosity of the help that was given. The real shocker in this story is not about the fact that the priest only gets 2 verbs. He saw and he passed. And the Levite only gets 2 verbs. He saw and he passed. But the Samaritan gets 14 verbs. He saw. He went. He had pity. He poured on oil and wine. He put the man on his own donkey. He took him to an inn. All of these different verbs of action that the Samaritan is offering help. But that's not the real shocker of the story. That's not what would have shocked the people who were hearing it the first time. In fact, the scandalous part of this story that is the reason that Luke would have wanted to record it after he heard it. The reason that Luke would want to preserve this story for posterity. The reason he thinks it's important for you to hear this story is because of the identity of the helper. Because when Jesus says that a priest and a Levite walked right by the injured man, the audience probably was not shocked by that. I mean, you think about the kind of, put yourself in that situation. You're walking alone, desolate wilderness, and you can tell immediately that something is out here attacking folks. You know? I mean, like, this is not a good spot to be in. And you're thinking to yourself, I could stop right here and anything could go wrong. I'm going to keep on going, right? Like, it just kind of makes sense. And so everybody who would have heard about the priest and the Levite walking by on the other side of the road after seeing this potentially dead body or almost dead body, I mean, it's a creepy situation to be in. And so the real shocking feature of this story is who the hero turns out to be. Because in Jesus's day, Samaritans are not just strangers. Samaritans were opponents. Samaritans were the outsiders who claimed to be the true people of God and also claimed that all of the Jewish trappings of their religion, their temple, their altars, their sanctuary cities, all of their worship was false. All of their religious leadership were imposters. Their temple was unauthorized. The Samaritans are the people who criticize and ridicule and minimize the value of what the Jews are doing. The Samaritans and the Jews had a centuries-old conflict, a feud with each other that would have made the Hatfields and the McCoys look like just a little spat. You know? I mean, about 100 years before Jesus was born, there was a Jewish high priest. His name was John Hyrcanus. And he was not only the high priest religiously for the Jews, but he was the king of Judea. And he led a military campaign into Samaria, decimated their villages, but his main target, what he was really after, was all of their religious icons and locations. He tore down their altars. He destroyed their temple on Mount Gerizim. And he took a whole bunch of Samaritans and forced them into slavery. This is the kind of history that exists between these two groups of people. During Jesus' lifetime, there's a historian named Josephus who tells us that during Jesus' lifetime, there was an incident on the weekend of the Passover when a group of Samaritan men snuck in at night to the Jewish temple and they brought with them a cartload of human dead bodies and they scattered the bodies all over the temple to make the temple ceremonially unclean and to make a mockery of the Jewish worship. This is the ultimate insult to the Jews. It cements and perpetuates the hatred between these two groups of people, and it's pretty bad. In fact, just the very chapter right before this story, if you look back at Luke chapter 9 in your Bible, there's a passage in there, a story where Jesus needs to travel through Samaria, where the Samaritans live, and instead of giving him a warm, hospitable welcome, the Samaritan villages all give him the cold shoulder. And Jesus' Jewish disciples are like, man, this is our opportunity. Not only do we have every reason to be mad at these folks, but we've got Jesus with us. So they're like, hey, Jesus, what do you feel? What do you think about calling down fire and just burning these villages to the ground? Because they don't care about the Samaritans. That's the kind of tension that exists between these two people. The Samaritans were despised. The Samaritans were suspect. The Samaritans were deplorable to the Jews. And as far as Jesus's listeners were concerned, when they heard him tell this story for the first time, there was no such thing as a good Samaritan. But I wonder what the man in the ditch thought. When I was a kid growing up in Sunday school, all of the visual aids that they would use to teach these kinds of stories, when they would come to the Good Samaritan story, it always showed a guy laying there battered and bruised, but he had his eyes closed. And so somehow, growing up, my mental picture of this story always imagined that he was laying there unconscious. But I just wonder, imagine what it would be like if he was conscious the whole time. Imagine he's dazed and confused. His body is shaking because he's slipping in and out of shock. But through his one good eye, the one that hasn't swollen shut yet, and through a veil of blood that's dripping down his face, he saw that priest walk by. And he tried to make some noise. He grunted a little bit, but it seemed like when he did that, the priest just started walking faster. And when the priest started getting far away and it was obvious he wasn't going to help, the man started screaming, but it didn't help. And then the same thing happened with the Levite approached and then moved to the other side of the road as he passed and didn't respond to any of his pleas for help at all. But then, just as the man is laying there in the ditch thinking it's hopeless, and he's looking up and he sees a vulture circling up overhead, and then he looks and there's a Samaritan with a donkey. His clothing gives him away. And when he gets closer and says something, his accent verifies he's a Samaritan, all right. And any other day of the week, these two guys probably would have passed each other on the road. And as they did, they'd give each other the side eye. And once they got within earshot, they might hurl insults at one another. And then when they passed by each other, they'd probably keep one eye on that guy, make sure he wasn't going to pull anything. Any other day of the week, the Jewish guy would not be caught dead on a Samaritan's donkey. But on this day, when he nearly is dead, the Samaritan and his donkey are this man's saving grace. And it turns out that when you're all alone and when you're in desperate need of help, you'll take help from almost anywhere you can get it, won't you? When you have no other options, when you're all by yourself, when things look really bleak, you'll give up your prejudice about who you're associating with, won't you? I've read some ugly, tragic, but true stories about white hospital patients who refuse to be treated by the black physician who walks into their room. But you know what I've noticed about those stories? And I've read multiple ones of them. I've noticed that it's always a situation where the patient is not in a life-threatening condition. They're not critical. They have the luxury of waiting and the option to ask for someone else. But what you don't hear about is stories of dying accident victims who request a different paramedic. You don't ever hear that story. Because when your situation is serious, when your situation is dire, you get a lot less picky about who's going to help you. And I don't know if you've noticed, but one of the most difficult and challenging things about reading the Bible, and especially reading these parables of Jesus, is it's sometimes hard to figure out which of the characters in the story you're supposed to relate to. Usually, when I've read and studied and listened to teaching about the parable of the Good Samaritan, usually I walk away feeling like this is an instruction for me to be generous like the Samaritan was. This is a story that's meant to remind me that when I see people who are in need, it's my job to step up because there's other people who aren't going to do it. But I just wonder if Jesus is inviting us this morning to identify with the man in the ditch. In fact, I think Jesus is using this story to help us reimagine who our neighbor might be. You remember this story is told in the context of a public conversation with a Jewish legal expert. You remember that's how we got into this thing in the first place. The legal expert asked Jesus to be more specific about who the neighbor is that we're supposed to love. And so after the parable comes to an end, Jesus tells the story and wraps it up with this question. He says, which of the three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, which of the three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? And it's interesting. Some translations will say, and I think it's a good way to translate that particular Greek word, some translations don't say which of the three was a neighbor. They'll say which of the three became a neighbor. Which of the three decided to become a neighbor to the man who was in the ditch? And the legal expert can't even bring himself to say the word Samaritan. He says through gritted teeth, the one who had mercy on him, the one who stepped up, the one who helped. And it makes all the difference in the world when you read this parable. It makes all the difference in the world which character in the story you identify with. Because there's two ways that I could share this sermon and this message with you this morning. And there's an easy way and there's a hard right way. The easy sermon for me to preach, the oversimplified lesson that you and I could take away from this little cute little story and not be offended at all, is if I just said, your neighbor is the person you can see who needs your kindness. That'd be the easy way to preach it. That the neighbor is the person you see who's in trouble, who's in need, who requires some help, and you should step up. You should be like the Samaritan and put your prejudice and your politics and everything else aside when somebody else has a need. But the thing is, if we go with that version, if we go with that moral to the story, it leaves all this wiggle room for interpretation. Because here's what happens. You'll be driving and you'll come to a stoplight. And you'll see somebody standing by the side of the road and they're panhandling and they've got a sign that says, I am in need. Like it could not be any clearer. They're giving you like a clear message that says, I'm in need. But it's so easy at a moment like that to follow a train of thought that convinces you they probably don't really need help as bad as they're putting on. They've probably already gotten a lot of help. It's probably not as bad as it looks. And it's easy to convince yourself that if your job is just to respond to needs, to convince yourself, well, I ought to wait and see if there's a bigger need later. You know? It's easy when you are watching TV and you see footage of refugees who are being turned away at the border, and then the governor of our state announces this week that we're going to be the only state in the country that's not going to accept vetted refugees for resettlement this year. It's easy to respond to that and convince yourself, well, they've got other options. To think to yourself, well, they've got other neighbors. They've got neighbors where they came from. We don't really owe them anything. It's easy It's easy to follow that train of thought. It's easy when you see images of civilians who are being bombed and shelled and terrorized on the other side of the world. It's easy to think somebody, that's somebody else's problem because that's somebody else's neighbor. It's easy to follow that train of thought. But if you identify yourself with the man in the ditch, if you put yourself in the place of the man in the ditch who's left for dead in this story, then suddenly your filter changes. If you imagine yourself in desperate need of help, and then you get, you'll notice you start to get less selective about where your help comes from. And so Jesus doesn't ask, who was the Samaritan's neighbor? Jesus doesn't ask, who was the Samaritan supposed to help? What was the Samaritan supposed to do that day? He doesn't ask that. The clearest, plainest reading of this incident that's reported from Jesus' life is that Jesus asks, who was a neighbor or who became a neighbor to the man who was dying? Who was the person who became a neighbor to the victim? And I imagine that if you went and asked him, I imagine that if you showed up at that inn where he had been cared for overnight and where the innkeeper had called in nurses to help during the day, I imagine that if you showed up and went up to his room and knocked on the door and you listened for that faint, come in, and you walked in and you asked him, hey, I've heard about this story of you getting beat up. Who showed up to be a neighbor for you yesterday? I imagine he would say the Samaritan. And I think that's the harder truth. The difficult pill to swallow in this story, that your neighbor is not just the person who needs your help. Your neighbor is anyone whose help you would accept if you were on your last leg and they were the only person to offer. Your neighbor is anyone that you would allow to help you if you were desperate. Your neighbor is the person that you would allow, anyone that you would allow to help you if you were injured, if you were alone, or if you were lost. Your neighbor is anyone that you would allow to pull you out of the burning wreckage. Your neighbor is anyone that you would allow to give you CPR when you stopped breathing. Your neighbor is anyone that you would allow to stop the bleeding for you. Your neighbor is anyone that you would allow to go in and rescue your drowning child. Which means your neighbor is anyone. Your neighbor is everyone. And that changes the meaning of what Jesus had to say as he introduced this little parable. That changes the meaning of what Jesus affirmed in the opening to this episode when he said the way to inherit eternal life is to love God and love your neighbor. Because your neighbor is everyone. You know, it's my dream, and I think it's God's dream for Heritage, that we would be a church that our community considers indispensable. I dream of a day when the Heritage Homeowners Association and Tarrant County and the City of Fort Worth and Keller ISD and the families with whom we share a property line and the families in the neighborhoods that surround our church campus think of us as a welcome partner and a valuable addition to this community. And I believe the way that that happens is when we live as neighbors, not passively, but actively live as neighbors to all of our community, the entirety of our community, the whole of our community. We have to find ways to actively treat everyone we encounter in our community as someone who's valuable and somebody that we appreciate. We have to find ways to actively show that everybody that we meet in our community represents somebody who carries full humanity and the image of God inside them. We have to find ways to stop sitting in judgment or being perceived as sitting in judgment. We have to find ways to stop throwing shade at people who don't live or look or vote or believe like we do. And I believe when we do that, when that happens, we're going to start to look like the kinds of neighbors that the world wants to see coming when they're on their last leg. We're going to start to look like the kinds of neighbors that the lonely are happy to see, and that the injured are thankful showed up. We're going to begin to look like the kinds of neighbors that the depressed long to connect with. We're going to begin to look like the kinds of neighbors that Jesus was to us. You see, in the moment when we were least deserving, when we didn't even realize how bad off we were, Jesus showed up, crossed boundaries, offered himself generously, compassionately to care for us, even when we would have rather done it all on our own. But Jesus showed up and was a neighbor to us. And I believe that as the city on a hill that God has planted in this neighborhood, we have an opportunity, we have a calling and a mission to be that kind of neighbor. Not to a few, but to our entire community.